Hello everyone, this is Mitch Saunders with Swing Politics with Big Mitch, and it is a lovely 10 a.m. Tuesday morning here in Medford, Massachusetts. I'm going to get set up, and I will be right back on the air in about 45 seconds. Looking forward to chatting. All right, ready to go here, and it has been an exciting week here in American politics. Just making sure microphones are working. Perfect. All right, we are ready to go. So, I'm going to start out with a little bit of a fun fact this morning, because I heard it on a podcast this morning, and I think that it's super interesting. Heard it from a podcast called, Strange Political Tidbits in History, and I think that it was really interesting. So we talk a lot about primarying candidates, how candidates on, Democrats and Republicans will be primary either from their left or from their right, every now and then from a moderate flank, and the term to primary as a verb came from the 2004 Pennsylvania Republican Senate primary of Arlen Specter, who was the incumbent Republican, who was sort of a more moderate Republican, didn't agree with Bush on various things, and would turn out to then become a Democrat in 2009 during the Obama administration. And he was attempted to be primaried from the right by Pat Toomey, who went on to in 2010, in 2010 to win Arlen Specter's Senate seat. And it was really the first major time that a political candidate that wasn't laden with issues surrounding their sort of personal life, or they didn't have a scandal, essentially. It was the first time when an incumbent that didn't have a scandal was actually going to be primaried by someone who ideologically felt that they were more pure and that they fit the seat better than the incumbent Republican. And so that I thought that was really interesting that we talk about primarying candidates a lot. We talk about who's going to get primaried in Congress this year, and yet it just so turns out that, that's only from 20 years ago. And I thought that was really neat. I encourage you to check out that podcast if you're a political junkie like me. But because there was so much this week, and you know that I can talk for a long time about politics, I am going to get started with the important stuff here. So what was the big deal this week, or from the last week, I suppose? Biden's State of the Union. So, Biden's speech hit on a lot of policy proposals, hit on a lot of things that Democrats are very proud of, and that the everyman voter appreciates, raising corporate tax rates, expanding welfare programs, maintaining Social Security, gun control, abortion rights, everything that the median voter is in favor of. And so the reality of the situation, though, is how was the speech categorized by the news outlets? Because the reality of the situation is all American voters, most American voters, some American voters, even a small sect of American voters, most people are not watching this. So you're not going to have an enormous swath of American voters that are suddenly going to tune into this and they know Biden's my guy. Suddenly we have, big swings in 2024 because everyone watched State of the Union. The State of the Union this year was higher than his last three in terms of media viewership, but doesn't mean that the voters were paying attention, especially the voters who count, the voters who really are unsure about which guy they're going to vote for or whether they're going to vote for Biden. So what Biden had to do was he had to perform as if swing voters and as if the whole country was watching, because about 32 million Americans were. But the more important thing was for him to shape the media narrative, because once the media has a narrative that, oh, Biden came out strong, really had a good performance, that will eventually trickle down in the news sources. People will hear that, and then they'll start changing their opinion on Biden. It's not going to be necessarily that the Biden campaign is going to do it directly, but it's going to be an indirect movement from the news sources. And here were the front pages of a few, here were a few articles that came out the morning after Biden's State of the Union speech. Axios: Biden's State of the Union address fuels biggest fundraising day of his reelection campaign. He raised $10 million in 24 hours. Reuters: Biden takes on Trump and Republicans in fiery State of the Union. New York Times: offering a choice of revenge versus decency, Biden strikes a contrast with Trump. The Hill: majority of Americans watching Biden's State of the Union speech had a positive response, CNN poll. So, from what I can tell, based on what I've seen, based on what I've heard, based on the people that I've spoken to at this college campus who are politically engaged, Biden had a good speech. He spoke not only about the things that mattered, but he spoke about them in a meaningful way. And that was a way that was engaging with the members in the Congress, whether it be Democrats or Republicans, which he sparred with a little bit and did well at, or whether it was the sort of demonstration to the American people that he has the capability to lead. He's been doing this forever. And it makes it also really easy to seem that way when Republicans have put the bar for what his mental acuity on the floor. So if he came out there and said a few sentences and didn't stumble, then he would have won. Unfortunately for Republicans, he really, really leapt over that bar. It was a really, really phenomenal way for Democrats to change and shift the narrative. The narrative is no longer Biden is old and does not have the competency to lead the country. Now it's Biden had a good speech, and we're going to see where he goes with this. And from what I can tell with his campaign events in Pennsylvania and Arizona, or Pennsylvania and Georgia, sorry, that he hasn't really, he's gotten a new confidence in him after this. I think that it is now how the media translates this over time, and how voters will interpret Biden's new attitude, Biden's ability to maintain a level of not youthfulness, because he never will, and I think the joking about his age is a good thing, but the proof that being around a long time might mean that I'm old, but it doesn't mean that I am incapable. And I think that Biden is going to start to prove that. So this campaign reset that was going on with all the negative polling that had, Biden's too old, Trump's like only, 4 years younger, and he was not determined as too old. I think it's very, very important. It came at a really good time. And it's clear that fundraising-wise, he's been doing gangbusters. $10 million in 24 hours is awesome. That's basically 10% of his haul from the last 3 months. A little bit less than 10%. But the reason why Biden's speech was also so good was because it spoke to the Democratic Party. Biden was speaking to swing voters here because all the things that he was talking about were popular to swing voters. However, the biggest thing about Biden's reelection, the biggest issue right now at least, is base concerns with Biden's abilities. And that's a lot on the Democratic side. Because the reason why he's trailing in polls and his approval rating is down is because of Democrats saying they're not totally sure they want to stick with Biden this time. And I think that this speech might not solve that issue, but it is the first step to ensuring that the Democratic base is solidified around a president who has been the most successful for liberal policy since LBJ in the 60s. Hands down. More so than Obama, more so than Clinton, more so than Carter. So Biden did exactly what he had to do with this speech. Republicans couldn't do anything to play off of it. They really, the attack ads that might come from it are going to be few and far between. And it is the media cycle that will now be able to, argue, or there are, sort of the media cycle will not be so dreary on the Biden campaign because of the candidate's abilities himself. So it was a very, very important speech for Biden, which he really did knock out of the park. And the rebuttal was, also perceived by standard media outlets as kind of brutal. Not so good for the Republican side. Here's what Politico had to say. Brit's Kitchen State of the Union rebuttal garners barbs from Trump allies, enemies alike. Washington Post. Katie Britt's kitchen table rebuttal to the State of the Union baffles GOP. The Hill. Britt roasted on social media for actorly State of the Union response. So, the fact that Biden's speech outperformed expectations, and the junior senator from Alabama, her speech was kind of funky and scary and strange, really was a phenomenal juxtaposition of the two parties. I think that this will not really change the game in any major way, but it sets a tone that can change the course of this campaign. And the rebuttal sort of just proved yet again Republican incompetency at the electoral stage. Essentially, if you're not Trump or you're not running on the ballot with Trump, it's you're waffling and you're really unable to capitalize on the Republican misgivings about the Democratic Party. They're just not good necessarily at politicking. And I think this indicates that. I feel that they felt descriptive representation was important, and it certainly is. The fact that Katie Britt is young, and the fact that she's a woman, both of those things are a foil to what they expected Biden's speech to be, was an old blubbering man who doesn't really know how to operate and can't lead this country. But look at how young we are. Look at how, you know, diverse we are, essentially, as a Republican Party that really has not embraced women largely due to their policies on abortion, but also historically, and, you know, women's rights in general. So I think that it was teed up to be a Republican victory, but they did not anticipate Biden doing well. In fact, from what I understand, based on reporting that I've heard, is that the Lake and Riley stuff about the, you know, the undocumented immigrant and the, you know, Georgia citizen who was killed by an undocumented immigrant, that Biden was not expected to even say her name, Laken Riley. And it turns out in the speech he did, and it was in a rebuttal to Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was yelling at him from the House floor, because that's good decorum. You know, Republicans are always expected to hold themselves to the highest standard of ethics. But the State of the Union rebuttal expected him to not say Laken Riley, so she couldn't. It was cut and spliced in such a way. And I think that that's indicative of how the speech went overall. Because if the speech really was not good, then Katie Britt would have come out looking good no matter what she had said. But that wasn't the case. And that was almost unexpected. And I think that's also the reason why news outlets are really going to run with this, as, you know, Republicans are, you know, who did they choose? And, you know, Biden's a safe choice, because he will be the safe choice in November. I think I've spoken a lot about the State of the Union, and it's definitely a you know, a Biden win for this week for his campaign. It better be a consistent mood change amongst the Democratic Party, who are notorious bedwetters at thinking that everything will go wrong for them, and really push this campaign to prove what it can do for the American people if it's given the chance. But what I'm going to head off to is a little bit of the Super Tuesday results in California. I was clapping when we found out that Adam Schiff, the congressman who was the first impeachment manager for Trump's first impeachment, will be in a general election with Steve Garvey, the former baseball player. And the reason why I was so happy, which I talked about on my last show, is that Democrats are now going to save a ton of money. The next in line after Garvey in terms of total amount of vote get was Representative Katie Porter, who represents the Orange County area in California's 47th congressional district. And had Katie Porter won, she was not close. She was 20 points behind Garvey, I believe. But had she come in second place, and it was Schiff versus Porter, Democratic fundraisers would have had a barrage of emails that would be requesting them to save California's seat and to allow them to win the election, you know, against fellow Democrat, and to this onslaught of fundraising emails from Katie Porter and Adam Schiff. And the reason why this would have been bad is that it would have taken away from other Senate races that are actually competitive, like Montana, like Ohio, like Wisconsin, like Michigan, like Pennsylvania, like Arizona. All of these are necessities to hold and flip, to hold the Senate. It's a very, very tough map this year, as I've spoken about many times on this show. But Porter being the number two would have meant that money would have been siphoned to a Democratic race in a Democratic state, where it would have been essentially burnt instead of being put to good use on a competitive Senate race that really, really needs the money. And so instead, what we're left with is Steve Garvey, who's a Republican, versus Adam Schiff, who's a Democrat, and Schiff doesn't need to raise any more money. In fact, because he is a team player, and because I know he is a team player, he won't really be fundraising at all. He might be fundraising for other candidates at some point, maybe, or sending out an email from the Biden campaign saying, "Hey, it's Adam Schiff. You know, we impeached Trump, and we need you to help stop him once again from a second presidency, for a second term," something like that. But Adam Schiff doesn't need to spend a dime to win against a Republican in California. California voted for Biden by about 25 points in 2020. There's no world in which it's going to elect a Republican senator, regardless of how good a candidate he might be. Regardless of, even if Trump were to sweep and have a really, really huge Electoral College victory, there's no way that a Republican candidate wins in California as a senator. I don't remember the last time that a senator won, Republican candidate won for the Senate race in California. The last time that, at least from what I can recall, a Republican won statewide was Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2006 as the Republican GOP candidate. But what I also thought was a very interesting thing is that Adam Schiff is a straight white man, and the last time that California was represented by a white man was, before the 90s. Because prior to this, we had Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, who were representing the state for quite a while. So I just thought that was a little interesting tidbit of information, but I'm very, very happy that Schiff is the nominee, because he's a really good, solid, mainstream Democratic player who does not cause strife in the party. And he won't need to raise any more money to win this race. So that's a big deal. That was the biggest win. I think that Republicans, in terms of other House primaries that had gone on, it was sort of a mixed bag of victories for Republicans and Democrats. Republicans sort of were able to stave off some MAGA challengers in a bunch of congressional districts. One notably was North Carolina's first congressional district, where Representative Don Davis was drawn into a much more competitive seat after Republicans gerrymandered their fair seven Democratic congressional map to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats with one toss-up district. And Don Davis is in that toss-up district. He's a phenomenal representative who will be running against Lori Buckout, who is just a political newcomer, who is fighting against Sandy Smith, who was more the MAGA candidate of this possible primary. And so that was a bit of almost a victory on the Republican side, because a MAGA candidate would have a harder time winning in a toss-up district than a more moderate Republican. But this candidate is just as Trumpy as the rest, at least ideologically. Maybe not quite as insane. But there was that's one example. There were a lot of, mixed bag of results. I think Democrats had some results they were happy about. Republicans had some results they were happy about. The whole night can be chalked up as a victory solely because of the California Senate race, by far, for Democrats. So, big deal on that. But what also happened after Super Tuesday, and on Super Tuesday, obviously, the presidential primary with Trump versus Haley. But shortly after Super Tuesday, Nikki Haley dropped out. Now, Haley was never going to win this nomination. It was clear from the get-go. However, she demonstrated that a number of Republicans don't want Trump, that they're not happy with the option that they have, and that Haley was, a form of sort of protest vote that they were either, not so happy with, or they were very gung-ho about, and that they really didn't want Trump again, possibly because he wouldn't win, possibly because he was too extreme, maybe both these things combined. But there were critical masses of voters in these states that really, really wanted not Trump-Biden rematch. They wanted a different Republican candidate. A Republican candidate who could win, because to be fully honest with you, if it was Nikki Haley versus Joe Biden, Nikki Haley would probably wipe the floor with him. But part of this, some argue, is that a lot of the reason why Haley did so well was because of independents who really vote like Democrats, and because of Democrats who wanted to participate in the primary because they felt that they had, you know, there was no point in just voting for Biden in the primary, and that, you know, there would be another chance for them to stop Trump and vote against him. Now, that is definitely the case. But to the extent that is the case is unclear. And I think that it's made more clear by looking specifically at the election results from Super Tuesday and the presidential primaries that were open or closed primaries. So an open primary is one where no matter what party you're registered with, you can vote in whatever primary you choose. So I'm a Democrat. I can participate in the Democratic primary, or I can participate in the Republican primary. I only get one ballot, of course, but I can do either. There are some states that are open but limited, so you are in the Republican primary at least. Republicans can vote in the Republican primary, independents can vote in the Republican primary, but Democrats cannot cross over and vote in the Republican Party. And then there's closed primaries, which is just for your party. So if you're registered as an independent or a Democrat, you cannot vote in the Republican primary. So starting with the open primaries, where anyone from any party can vote, you had a decent amount of support for Haley in, you know, blue-leaning swing states. In Minnesota, you had 29% of the vote for Haley. That's basically 3 in 10 voters voted for Haley. In Virginia, 35% voted for Haley. In Colorado, 33% voted for Haley. When you get to more of the southern states, there's more of a tradition it's a little bit less open to sort of primary challengers, and I think it's more of a southern phenomenon than it is an open primary phenomenon. And the reason why is because Texas, you got 17% wanted Haley, and Arkansas, 19% voted for Haley. And those are also both open primaries. So to have 35% voting for Haley in Virginia and 17% voting for Haley in Texas is sort of there's a big question as to why were these votes so different if they were both the same type of open primary. And I think that the reason why is because of the fact that it's just geographical differences, historical differences, and sort of a tighter-knit Republican Party in southern states versus northern or liberal-leaning states. You know, you think that these geographic differences don't mean anything after hundreds and hundreds of years, but they really do. After decades, I would say. Hundreds and hundreds of years, this country isn't quite that old. But the open primary showed that there was a decent amount of resistance that Republicans didn't really want, Haley. But also, it could have been Democrats and independents who also voted for Haley and didn't feel that there was a point to voting for Biden on the primary ballot because there was no one else against him. So, on average, at least, 26.6% out of those five states, it was 26.6% that voted for Haley. Now, we'll get into why that's important in the future. The next set of primaries, there were only three that were open to Republicans and independents, so they were somewhat open, were Maine, North Carolina, and Massachusetts. Maine, 20% voted for Haley. In North Carolina, 23% voted for Haley. And in Massachusetts, 37% voted for Haley. These are relatively similar numbers. They're somewhere, they average out to, weirdly enough, 26.6% as well, which is the exact same as the open primaries. I think what that tells you is just that Democrats were really not picking up a ballot and voting for Nikki Haley frequently in these states. I believe in South Carolina, which was one of the last truly competitive, or not really truly competitive, but the last major primary before Super Tuesday, 4% of the ballot pickup individuals for the Republican primary were Democrats, because South Carolina is an open primary as well. So I think what it just says is that these numbers are not coming from Democrats, at least. And that's a really good sign for Biden, at least, in my opinion. Because if you have Democrats that are going to the polls and voting for Biden, and they're not going to vote for, you know, they don't want to turn out for Haley, and you know, it's an option to vote for Haley, but they really don't want to. I think it's the reason why it's a good sign for Biden is because there is more turmoil and more division in the Republican Party than these numbers might suggest on the surface, because everyone will just say, oh, but Democrats can participate. And I'm sure Democrats turned out in droves to support Haley against Trump, when the reality of the situation is it wasn't the case. And that point is further bolstered by on the same Super Tuesday night, two closed presidential primaries in Oklahoma and Tennessee. Now, these are southern states. These are states with super, super Republican electorates and are unrepresentative of, you know, a swing state population. But also, these elections are not really super meaningful. You try to glean what you can from these election results. And you know, what I'm drawing is, and I'll get into why it's sort of diminished in terms of the importance of it, but, you know, if 35% of the Republican Party was not voting for Trump, he would certainly lose in a landslide. And that's not going to happen, and I'll get into that in a second after I do these closed primary results. So in the closed primary in Oklahoma, 16% of Republicans voted for Haley. 16. That means out of 100 registered Republican voters, 16 of them voted for Haley. In Tennessee, it was 20%. So 1 in 5 1 in 5 Republicans voted for Haley. This is obvious. These numbers are obviously less than the open primaries, than the semi-open primaries, where you had independents who probably operate as Democrats, but maybe wanted to participate in these primaries to try to block Trump for whatever they could, have a say in them. Whereas the closed primaries do not have any independents. No independents, no Democrats, just Republicans. And so for 1 in 5 Republican supporters to not support Trump at the ballot is a really, really big deal on the surface, and general election-wise is going to be detrimental to Trump's odds of reclaiming the White House, and detrimental to Republicans nationally for every election. However, the reason why it's important to be so cautious with these numbers is that Trump doesn't get his support largely from primary electorates. Primary electorates are more educated and they're older. And because of that, Haley is going to perform better. They're also more suburban. The suburban voters, more educated voters, and somewhat older voters are all voters that are moving towards the Democratic Party. At the same time, these voters are the ones that are voting for Haley. If you look at a map of Tennessee, the Tennessee primary electorate, all of Haley's support comes from the suburbs and the cities. Those are also where Democrats find their support. So these numbers that 1 in 5 voters in Tennessee don't support Haley might be true in this small subsect of the electorate. But when you have a general election, Trump's base is with those that don't turn out for a primary. So suddenly that 1 in 5 voter is now 1 in 50 or 1 in 20, because you have non-college educated rural voters that are not aware of when these primaries are happening. They're not aware of when these elections are going on other than the general. Also, because Trump doesn't spend any money on the airwaves here. One, because he can't, because of all of the trials and the lack of fundraising. And two, because there's no need to, because he'll win in a landslide. But the lack of fundraising, coupled with the fact that this sect of college-educated, older, suburban voter is really motivated to go to the polls, is going to make it seem like there is a greater defection in the Republican Party than there really is come Election Day in November. Not to mention that a lot of these Republican voters, registered Republicans or independents, are Biden 2020 voters. They're lockstep Democrats who just never really changed their party affiliation. Because of the way the demographics are moving and the national realignment is occurring, you have suburban voters who voted for Republicans up until maybe 2014. and they registered as Republicans because they felt they were never, ever going to vote for Democrats. And suddenly, these voters are seeing the Trump, you know, the Trump party and these MAGA crazy people, and they're like, I can't stand voting for these people. And over time, from 2016 to 2024, these voters have become lockstep Democrats. But they just never changed their party affiliation. So that's also a reason why you could see Haley performing better in these Republican primaries. So these numbers, while they are objectively sort of a good thing for the Biden campaign to see and an unwelcome thing for the Trump campaign to see, they are well within sort of almost a normal confidence interval range of what you're expected to see in this primary contest. So if you look at, I'll give you an example. In 2008, after Obama received the nomination in the Democratic presidential primary, 53% of Clinton supporters said that they would vote for Obama. So that means 47% of Clinton voters said they did not want to vote for Obama in 2008. I mean, how did that turn out? In 2008, Obama won, I believe, 9 out of 10 Democrats, which means it couldn't have possibly been the case that one in two Hillary Clinton supporters didn't end up supporting Biden, didn't end up supporting Obama in the general election in November. A lot of these Haley voters will end up voting for Trump. A lot of them were already Biden voters. So all of this information together tells me that there is a possibility for defection from these voters, but it's not necessarily set in stone yet. And that's where the Biden campaign comes in, and that's where also the Nikki Haley endorsement comes in. And that's what I'll discuss next, because there is an enormous looming question over both campaigns as to whether or not Haley will endorse Trump. This is the next big political game changer that could happen over the next few months. My gut tells me that Haley will endorse Trump. Now, some might say that this is sort of shocking, that Trump has attacked Haley's character, that Trump is still attacking Haley on Truth Social right now, you know, calling her weak and ineffectual, and that she isn't representative of what the country wants, that she just is not... She's not part of this new Republican wave. This new Trump wave, I should call it, because it's not the Republican Party, it's the Trump Party. And with all of this, with these attacks on her character, I still believe that she will endorse Trump. If we think about Republicans in the past who Trump has attacked and they've gone on to endorse the presidential nominee, it's been all of them. Every single Republican that Trump has attacked, maybe barring Chris Christie, has endorsed Trump. You think about people like Tim Scott, like Marco Rubio, even trying to think of others, Nancy Mace, the members who were not, you know, even Lindsey Graham, members of Congress who were not totally sure about Trump in 2016, or maybe didn't love the way that he acted, during the time in his presidency, and yet they all endorsed him in 2016, and they all endorsed him in 2020. So why would Nikki Haley be any different? She wouldn't be, because Republican voters and Republicans themselves really forego and forget these attacks. While Trump's attacking Nikki Haley consistently because it gets a rise out of his base and maybe gets some fundraising in, he's quick to draw the line if Haley calls him up and says, look, you know, I don't want Biden to win in 2024. You're going to be better than, you know, you'll be better than he could ever be. I'm ready to bury the hatchet. Trump's going to hop on that train. and quickly go on to praise Nikki Haley for the work she did in his administration as the UN ambassador, and that the work that she did for South Carolina. It's really easy to sort of tear each other apart in the primary, but suddenly everyone starts singing Kumbaya, and Democrats are not sure how that happened all of a sudden, that Nikki Haley is in the Trump camp, and that there's no goal more important than beating Joe Biden. So while the voters forget the attacks, the Republican Party leadership is very quick to do so as well. I also think that a lot of people have been arguing that Nikki Haley is going to be set up for a 2028 bid, and that this is sort of her whole goal, is to not endorse Trump and then to take back the party in 2028. Quite frankly, that argument doesn't make any sense, because if Trump isn't there in 2028, it's going to be someone else. It's going to be someone else he endorses. It's going to be, you know, his son, some or a whole bunch of candidates who fill this vacuum of the MAGA alt-right fascist wing of the Republican Party. If Haley feels that Trump is not going to win a general election, regardless of whether or not she endorses him, then she'll endorse him, he'll lose, and then she'll be able to argue in 2028, look, I endorsed the guy, I supported Trump, you know, I was with you all. But it's time for a new face. It's time for a new direction. If anything, that message resonates far better with Republican bases than I was against your guy who you voted for 70%, who 70% of you voted for in the primary. In some way, it sets her up better for a 2028 run, for her to say, look, I can placate the moderates, I can placate the extremists, I can have it all. But now you need to side with me because I supported Trump in 2024, didn't work, I think it's time for a new direction. And what I'll say is Haley will only endorse Trump if she feels he cannot and will not win a general election, even with her endorsement. And on March 10th, so 2 days ago, she was on CNN and she said Trump cannot in any way win a general election. So because of that, it doesn't matter how much attacking he's done on her brand, on her character, on her candidacy. She feels that even if she endorses Trump, Trump will not win a general election. And that's what she's banking on. That's why I think she's going to endorse Trump. The only reasons why she would endorse him would be that it would go back on the attacks that she made on him and, you know, sort of just take on all of the mudslinging that the Trump campaign has done to her. But the reality of the situation is, why would Haley suddenly have such ethical, moral, upright concerns and shame about how she is perceived nationally? Because she admitted on the debate stage that if Trump was convicted, she would still vote for him. If that's the case, can't give much more fealty than that. And there's the argument again about trying to take back the party in 2028. But if he loses, and she's there, it's just going to be another person that's going to fill the void. I think that's just how it works. So, Haley will endorse Trump because he will not win a general election and because she truly believes that. In terms of, you know, we spoke about where Trump might have trouble, and the trouble that, you know, Trump is going to have is with suburban swing voters, and that Haley's made that clear in her primary, in the primary states with which she has been a candidate. Biden's problem is going to be, is from what I can tell based on the data so far, is that he is going to struggle significantly with Hispanic voters, more so than any other group. the reason why he's going to is because the constant Republican hammering of the messaging on immigration and essentially nothing else hits home with these voters who don't believe that all the things that Republicans say Democrats all the things that Republicans say Democrats won't do, they actually will do. Because and quite frankly, in the border bill that was just put up that Biden referenced in the State of the Union, all of the things that Republicans said they wanted to do and say in these attack ads that they plan to do that Democrats block, they can't say anymore because Republicans blocked the bill. They did the exact same thing twice before. In 2013, they requested a stronger immigration bill. Democrats drafted the bill, and then Republicans tanked it. In 2018, Republicans wanted stronger measures. Republicans drafted the bill with Democrats in a bipartisan fashion, and then Republicans killed the bill also with uniform control of the government. They held the House and the Senate and the presidency, and they still couldn't get a border bill passed. So to say immigration is on the Democratic Party, you know, as a failure is confounding. And it's also a myth that I've broken down on this, you know, broadcast before, because it's Trump sanctions in Latin America that have caused the economic strife and have caused the greater amount of immigration. So Republicans have branded themselves as the party that's tough on immigration, and Trump argues for, you know, draconian rules with migrant camps and border patrol units in cities trying to find undocumented immigrants. I mean, it's stuff of 1984. Yet Democrats are the ones that have worked for stricter immigration policies, which the majority of Americans support and the majority of Hispanic voters support. So the hammering and the messaging and the reason why Biden is doing so well, I mean, it's very possible that Biden is not doing well with these voters because of a different reason, but it's not from what the polling is telling us, at least. It's not from what I can tell. But Republicans have hammered themselves consistently as strong and tough on immigration and tough on crime, when the reality is they couldn't be any weaker. Because they killed the bipartisan deal because Trump told them to. And if I'm the Biden campaign in this instance, what I'm going to say is, look, we had the border bill. It was your nominee that tanked it, and this is going to run on every single attack ad and every single Biden ad in majority Hispanic regions and in majority minority cities, counties, wherever. Because the greatest defections from the Democratic Party in this primary is along the Rio Grande Valley, where there's a big Hispanic, very, very large, sizable Hispanic population, and in other counties with Hispanic voting populations who are unhappy with Biden's policies. And I'm not sure, I think it could be, you know, a cacophony of rationale as to why they don't support the president. But this is the one that at least polling is telling us is the biggest concern to voters and, you know, obviously Republican voters and Hispanic voters, especially in competitive locations more so than anywhere else. And so the Biden campaign really, really wants to, really must maintain these voters and prove that he is doing what he can to implement stricter border guidance, more stricter border legislation that Republicans have blocked. And what I think is so interesting is that it's a major pivot from Democratic Party standard, policy on immigration. Standard immigration on policy was, I think, a little bit more waffly. It was a little bit more pathways to citizenship. And this this policy is a little bit less of that, which I'm unhappy about. I think that the pathways to citizenship should be plentiful. But right now, it's an election year, and that's not going to happen. And you also don't have the Democratic support for it. So it's going to be a really important thing that the Biden administration campaigns on this border deal that they worked hard for. And they started with the State of the Union. But more, I think I'm going to do more analysis on where the Biden campaign is really sort of leeching their support in the future. There's been a lot of bedwetting over the African American community and their support for the Biden campaign. The primary data doesn't say that there's going to be any major issues with that. Look, is it important that Biden campaigns and proves to these voters that he deserves their vote? Of course, as he should with, you know, every sect of the Democratic Party. But at least in terms of what's coming up as registered, it's not the African American vote that seems to be the biggest driver of concern for the Democratic Party for Biden's reelection campaign. And what I'll end on is a little fun fact, started with a fun fact, ending with a fun fact, that in North Carolina, in the Democratic presidential primary, you had Robeson County, which is sort of the along the border of South Carolina and North Carolina. It's in the Sand Hills region, which is a ancestrally Democratic location, which is consistently turning more Republican with each cycle. And 37% of the voters there voted no preference for Biden, with 63% voting for Biden. And the reason why was because Robeson County is 41% Native American. So I don't know what exactly the issues are with the Biden campaign and the Native American community, but I'm interested to find out more and hear more about how Biden is going to shore up their support. Or maybe if it's just not so real and it's just a protest vote for now, because there is no one else, which is something that's been common in these primaries moving forward and will be. In Michigan, Minnesota, and other states that have voted, that the uncommitted vote is not that they will not vote for Biden in the general, but that they will, they want him to earn his vote. And I think it's an interesting take. So for now, this is Big Mitch Saunders with Swing Politics. You're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. Thanks so much for listening in. I'll be back again next week at 10 a.m. to discuss more of this fun stuff in the political world. So thanks so much for listening in, and I'll catch you next week. Bye, everyone.
It hurts just to-